From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. Sometimes old friends take way, way, way too long to come back. Since Dan Klaus was last here in 2001, he's written at least two more screenplays, had those movies made, done a ton of other books. I shudder to use the phrase comic books, but he is a preeminent writer-illustrator whose work has such an emotional clarity and dynamism, and that's all more than evident in his new book, Monica. Dan, it's such a pleasure to have you back.
Such a pleasure to be here. I get 22 years, that's mind-boggling.
That's criminal. You've had a film career since then, and still do. And gosh, I mean, one of the things that just from section to section in the book, I mean, just thinking about the first panel, the first page of Foxhole, first of all, you know how much I love your illustration style. And there's something about the way you delineate and depict eyes that have so much, I think, such an emotional clarity, you know, and we know exactly the character's state of mind. And I want you to talk about where that comes from for you, because people so often say that people draw expressive eyes. They usually tend to mean big eyes or what we now call anime eyes. And that's not where you land with this stuff at all. So, I mean, because we know what the characters are feeling from not even the rest of the face. We can see it in their eyes, can't we?
What a great question. I feel like that is the key to the characters being able to, you know, communicate to the audience in a way that like an actor would. And so I actually leave the eyes blank until the entire page is all done. And then it's a matter of really getting it right. You know, I'll often pencil different eyes, just slightly different, and erase 20 times. I'm sure I did in that opening panel of Foxhole. And it's really about them feeling alive. That's where you feel the life. There are certain comics that look perfect to me. They look like they're really well drawn. You can't find a flaw, but somehow the characters feel like they're mannequins or they're zombies that are devoid of life. And it's all in the way the eyes just have a kind of a glassy tint to them.
Well, like the characters aren't really seeing anything. It's a great line that Jules Pfeiffer had in The Great Comic Book Heroes. They said they looked like they were drawn in a bank.
It's funny, people will, some of my artist friends will come over while I'm in the middle of working on a page, and they'll see the page with all the missing eyes, and they think I'm totally insane. And like, what are you doing? I was like, doesn't everybody do that?
But it's interesting, too, because, you know, I go way back, and we can, as far as I'm concerned, this entire interview could be about Battling American, but nobody would care. But what I will say, even in the stuff that will lean more towards the satirical, we still knew emotionally where the characters, I mean, just so often as not, especially in the satirical stuff, there's a kind of obsessive quality in the eyes that we see.
I mean, to me, the difference between like an illustrator and a cartoonist is if the characters seem alive. It's not something you can really teach or explain. Certain cartoonists who can't draw at all, their characters are just alive. They're walking on the page. You close the book and you think about them, and they're living their own lives off the page, and they're just real. And some of the most beautifully rendered characters are just, they just exist as illustrations, and they just have no life to them. And that's, to me, that's the difference between like a real cartoonist and somebody who's sort of using all the trappings of cartooning to kind of approximate a comic book or a cartoon. It's undefinable. You just can't really put your finger on it, but you know it exists. It's something we can all feel.
I think what you're talking about is what the kids would call AI, Dan.
Yeah.
I think that what's interesting so often, too, is there's often this kind of, there's this emotional vitality in so much of your work. And in Monica, certainly, you've collected a group of characters who kind of know what they want. Their self-obsession is so kind of petty in this book that it's just fascinating. You go, wow, how much worse could this be? I don't want to say worse, but how much more self-absorbed could this be? And then the next installment has even more of that.
It's about many things, but you know, it's about the main character kind of facing her aloneness. It's, you know, there are 9 stories in the book, and I think of them as like 9 different versions of aloneness. And, you know, and part of that is realizing that other people have their own goals and obsessions that aren't quite aligned with yours. That's, you know, she faces that over and over.
Again, we go back to Foxhole. We don't even meet her directly in the beginning of the story. I don't want to say it's a précis or a prologue, because the story has its own emotional life. And there are triggers I have in reading comics. Whenever I see a war comic, it's got to work really hard to make me invest in it, because there's something about, as we both know, those kinds of comics in the original iteration that was so pro forma, such kind of these O. Henry stories with a twist. And for the opening panel to make me think, I have to read this, really, you have to create something with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I wanted to think of it almost like an overture for the book, at least the way I work. I work in a very specific way, but it's really collecting ideas that just have a life to them. And years ago, I had this idea of sort of starting with this war story, and you kind of think you're invested in one character, and then you see the world back home that he's talking about, and you find out it's a very different thing. And you see that he's in a dream state, you know, he's sort of imagining a thing that doesn't exist. And I probably had that idea like 30 years ago, and I keep sketchbooks, and I transfer the good ideas from the old sketchbooks into the new sketchbooks. And some of them I keep transferring for 30 years, and they finally it's time to do this. And so that was really one of the starting points for this story.
Well, there's something fascinating too, that if you've read comics, also particularly war comics, you're struck by is, or neither of the characters, I should say, have 5 o'clock shadow, which immediately sort of tells us something in sort of subtextual terms that you're not coming out and plainly declaiming.
Yeah, well, I wanted the main guy to be kind of baby-faced. So he was, you know, to show his innocence, like he doesn't need to shave. The other guy I kind of imagined had a stubble. But once you start drawing little hairs, it kind of distracts from the rest of the face. So you have to be very subtle about that kind of thing.
It does, but there's just, again, that there's something about that that says this is something different than what you've seen before. But, I mean, for each chapter and each installment, I should say, just the title, the opening title font has this interesting sort of detachment from what the story is going to be.
I like titles that seem really prosaic and flat.
Yes, there's the titles that basically demand that we really pay attention, but that could be, you know, David Boring or Ghost World or Mr. Wonderful, any number of things you've done. The titles are meant to be emotionally two-dimensional, aren't they?
I've always wanted to do one of those, you know, like 70s titles that are long and complicated. You know, there's the one that's like, what does Hieronymus Merkin think of Mercy Hump, you know, like the unbearable lateness of being or something like that. But I always thought that would be a great curveball on my shelf of books to have one that's like completely different than the others. But I guess Like a Velvet Glove, Cast in Iron, that's as close as I'll ever get.
It's the Treban, my guest, who has aired in the simplicity in titles, is Daniel Clowes. His newest book of all original material is Monica. I guess I should say this too, because I wonder how long you've been working on this, because you said that that first story goes 30 years, and the last story feels like it's something you had in your head for a long time, because it's not really a summation at all. It tends to make us, each panel makes us think that Doomsday is going to take us to a place that sums everything up. But by the last three, we kind of realize, oh, that's not going to happen at all.
No spoilers, Elvis.
Well, in real terms, I can't say that there's not drama on that page, because there's an incredible amount of drama, though. But, you know, I mean, it just to do this thing, it's really powerful. But I said that before, Dan, is when we started, that it's a, I think, maybe your most powerful piece of work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, I spent longer on this book than any other book. I mean, as you say, some of the stories I've been gestating for like 30 years, but actual like sitting down and working and writing and figuring it out, it was roughly a 6-year process, which, you know, the book's only 106 pages. So it's, you know, it's a lot distilled into each page. I felt, you know, I sort of looked at like my age and thought like, how many more books do I have in me? You never know. I mean, right now I feel like I could do another one, but I thought, you know, I've got to really like do the best I can do and see how that feels, you know, now's the time. So I spent a lot more time just experimenting with ideas and figuring things out than I normally do. You know, I would try every permutation of an idea and see how, where it goes and follow the most interesting path after I did that.
It's funny you say that because there's a compactness that reminds me a lot of the earlier work. Because over the past, I guess we can say since you've last done the show 20 years, the books have gotten, I think, more epic. And this one almost feels like a response to your last book because that was such an emotionally sprawling book. There's a precision to these stories, isn't there?
My goal originally was just to have every story be like 8 or 9 pages. I wanted it to feel like an anthology of old horror comics or, you know, EC comics or, you know, like when DC comics were comprised of 3 8-page stories. I just think that length is so great. You know, you kind of get in and out, but of course my ideas are always bigger than, you know, my, page count. So I'm always expanding and, you know, always begrudgingly adding a page here or there. So I think the longest in here is about 24 pages, but I wanted them each to feel like they could work on their own as a story. Like you could read a story out of here on its own. And maybe you wouldn't quite get the bearings if you read one of the later stories, but you would at least be able to follow it on its own. And then to have them add up to something that's much different than they seem on their own.
Well, I mean, as we were saying, the earlier stuff was that. And it was really sort of compact and concise. And as they used to say in the old days, self-contained stories. And I felt like, you know, as the work, you start to ask more questions of your characters. I'm thinking of Wilson or Patience, then those books start to feel like they were bigger and more diffuse. And there's a concentration here. And it even takes me back in some ways to a lot of the earlier stuff where the first page of each section evokes a certain genre of comic.
That was sort of my original idea, was that each story would allude to a different genre. And as I workshopped that idea, as I figured it out, I realized that works sort of in the beginning, but then she, as her life develops and our lives develop, we can't really define our lives into simple genres and terms like that. So it's almost like she's developing her own genres that are genres mixed with other genres by the end. Like she's like the very last story feels like the genre is just her.
Yeah, it gets back to almost the simplicity of the first story. But each of the stories has this kind of melodrama that I've come to associate with you, which, because it's, again, it's so precisely rendered in the collection that's Monica, it's just sort of breathtaking.
I mean, I'm always trying to, especially with this book, trying to imagine it. It's really a life in a book. You know, I love the idea of a book as like a living being. You know, like the terms used to describe books are all corporeal. You know, it's like a book has a spine and a header. And so I really wanted it to feel like here's a life in a book. And I think the way we remember our lives are all these, I don't know, melodramatic, but, you know, heightened moments or moments that just have an indelible quality. And those moments are feel very much like when I'm working as, you know, trying to come up with ideas or images, where you get a jolt of inspiration, you know. And so I wanted the whole book to kind of feel like every panel had that kind of indelible inspiration to it. And, you know, in cases where I didn't really have that, I would leave the panel blank sometimes for 2 or 3 years till I finally felt the right moment that fit in.
We're talking about emotional precision with my guest, Daniel Clowes, whose new book is Monica. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. We're keeping it compact with our old friend who's been away for way too long, Daniel Clowes. His new book is Monica. This is The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcow.com/The Treatment. And gosh, Dan, as you were talking, I was thinking about so many of the panels that just are, for me, indelible. I mean, as often as not, it's a couple of pages in. I think about that page where the top panel is somebody with a baby stroller, because I'm trying not to give too much away here. But that panel and what follows, it's almost like these emotional snowflakes that fall. Each one is related to what's happened above in emotional terms, not strictly speaking in narrative terms. And that happens so often in this book. And that's where I think a lot of its potency comes from.
That, you know, that moment you're talking about with the baby stroller, I really wanted that to have that kind of jolt, like when you're watching a film and it's moving along at a certain pace, and then all of a sudden it cuts and you're, you know, 9 years later or something. I wanted it to have that kind of a jolt.
Well, especially because the characters are talking about sort of the carefree life that the pill might provide. And it's that moment that feels like, you know, the future will be consequence-free.
Right. I will say this story, Pretty Penny, is based, not the events aren't the same, but it's based very much on my own childhood with a mother who kind of went through that experience. You know, I think she thought the world was going to all of a sudden be, everything was going to go great and be easy. And then all of a sudden it was not.
I mean, it's just one of these moments that to see it rendered after the opening of the story. But again, all these stories, and I guess I want to ask you if there's a connective tissue for you or a theme, because each of these stories is about consequence.
I wanted it to almost be like a game of telephone where each story led in some odd way to the next story, but by the end you almost can't remember how you got here. it's a very subtle thing about how you decide what a book is about. I have to just work on it. I have to just find what's compelling to me. You know, what I always say, like the thing that will actually make me sit down at the drawing board every morning as opposed to not doing that, you know, has to be very compelling. So I'm just going into what is like exciting and interesting and feels maybe personal to me to get me going. And then it's kind of after it's halfway done that I start to look at it and go, ah, that's what it's about. Now I see. But I feel like I don't want to ever decide like this is going to be a book about, you know, imperialism.
Well, I don't know. At some point, every one of your books, somebody's attacking imperialism, so they could all be about that.
Well, and that's the, you know, you want to find out what you believe in the book, not tell other people what you think you believe. You know, so it's a humbling experience sometimes.
Again, I just found myself going back. First of all, just the fun of this is preparing for this, is just rereading everything. But going back to the beginning and just sort of seeing how the concentration and the determination to get to each story to end within roughly 10 pages. And then as April sort of like took on this life of its own, you could sort of see the characters in some ways sort of telling you what they were going to do. And by the time of Patience, each page almost seemed to be screaming, no, this is what this is going to be. It's going to take up this much time and this much space. And it almost felt like, as a reader, and I don't know what it was like in your writing it, you're being possessed by the spirit of this thing that is telling you where it wants to go.
Ideally, you want to get to a point where you're in sort of a combination of total dictatorial control and and like complete chaos, where you're not in control at all. And you kind of want the characters to start arguing back to you. You know, it's like, look, get over here. I want you to walk across the street. And the character's saying, well, I really don't think I would do that. And so that's the great state to be in, where it's almost like a collaboration. I mean, this is probably like an admission that I shouldn't make, but I actually think of the characters as being played by like a stable of old Hollywood actors. And I think of them as like, I have a troupe of like 20 actors that play all the characters, and they, you know, they put on wigs and mustaches and things. It's like the actress who plays Monica, you know, also would have played like Rebecca in Ghost World and Patience and you know, a few other characters. And now I'm working with her again and challenging her to a new role or something. You know, it's like, I guess deep down, I want to be Bergman and work with Lee Goldman.
That was that feeling of Patience, where that thing where actors get a script, they kind of go, no, this is mine now. I'm going to do with this as I will. And you could feel that in that's what I was saying, in Patience, it almost like the pages are turning themselves. No, this is going to go the way it's going to go. And so to go back in Monica, I don't want to say back to basics, but it reminds me of that sort of gem-like fluidity of the early stuff you did. It was like, well, this is over here. And it's hard to do this without giving too much away, and apparently I've given too much away already. But between sort of the last page of Glow Infernal and the first page of Demonica, I mean to say, where the last page of one story and the first page is like, wow.
Yeah, that's when, you know, you have to see it in print to sort of make the leap.
Well, we'll do this. My guess is Daniel Clowes, who is not making Can Hieronymus Merkin Find Mercy Home and Deliver True Happiness, that title he was trying to come up with in the first half of the show. His new book, his terrific new book, is Monica. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And I think what I was saying is that sort of sense of the character's dramatic lives, and it's been this sort of slow build over the course of your career, where the characters, the figures became less archetypal and more character-driven. And I can really sort of feel between Monica and Patience just what you did as a screenwriter, and that how that thing happens too when you're starting to write these characters and they take on these lives of their own. And I wonder if that was fun for you, kind of watching that sort of these forces, these emotional forces gallop away from you a little bit.
That experience you describe of actors saying like, well, my character would never do this. And I would think, well, actually, it's my character. I made it up. But the mixture of them and you, and they really become a different character. You can't really control it at a certain point. And somehow in the comics, of course, I can ultimately decide what they do. But once they start to act in ways that are mostly intuitive or unconscious, you know, things, decisions that just seem right, but I can't quite articulate, that's when they kind of become real characters and real people. I don't know. It's an interesting process.
Well, you were talking about characters. I think if I'm remembering this right, there's a character in The Incident who looks like William Conrad.
The Incident, you know, is supposed to be sort of informed by her years of watching 70s TV. So there's actually like Michael J. Pollard, Redford Dillman, who else? Yaphet Kotto. And then, yeah, William Conrad. People my age, my friends, have read the book. And of course, they identified all those actors. And then a few younger people were like, had no idea who any of them were when I brought it up. It's shocking to me somebody wouldn't know William Conrad.
Well, you're asking a lot of them to be able to identify Bradford Dillman and Yaphet Kotto, who, by the way, again, that gets that thing we were talking about too in these characters, the eyes and using like the emotional intent. Or in the case of somebody like Yaphet Kotto, the emotional intensity in that panel, the panels in which the couple of times we get to see him. I was just thinking as you were talking about that, about how we know these people in some ways as actors from their eyes, and you found a way to deliver that. And clearly, growing up and watching film and watching television, you wanted to depict that state that we got from watching actors deliver information while having to speak, which is what so much of comics are anyway, right?
Absolutely. And I, you know, I loved that world that you and I grew up in the 70s, where we knew all the actors. You know, we knew, it's like you could watch an episode of the FBI or something, and you're like, oh, there's that guy who was on Mannix last week. And you knew this sort of relatively small number of Hollywood faces, and it was like the world was distilled through these characters and actors, and it's something I've always wanted to recreate. It's like I have my own movie studio, and I'm like, you know, Harry Cohn or something. Yeah. Telling the actresses what to do.
I mean, so much of this, you're talking about being able to convey things the way movies do. And there's just this great turn, the last two stories going from, I guess it's Krug to Doomsday, the last panel of Krug, which almost jumps off the page. It's got this incredibly sort of emotional vibrance, but also this visual tableau, which is really kind of stunning, to that kind of pastoral, sleepy quality, the first panel of Doomsday. I mean, you do so much stuff in sort of visual dramatic terms. It's just so striking and I think unforgettable.
Yeah, I wanted that last panel of the story, Krug, to be almost like you're being electrocuted when you turn to it. I really wanted it to be like, just like sear your eyeballs, like a psychedelic poster under a black light. And then all of a sudden Doomsday is more like a gray summer day in coastal California. It's just a very different feel. You know, I wanted the book to have that kind of range and where those two things could be juxtaposed, and it's all part of the same thing somehow. They fit.
I mean, it's a great way of sort of saying a story has concluded without saying the end. And that last panel that we're talking about has sort of the pop of 60s psychedelia, along with that sort of that intense drama of the old EC Comics covers, where the covers themselves are pieces of storytelling, so much so that when you read the story, you kind of go, that's it?
Yes, exactly. Originally, my plan for this book was to color it much more like old 50s comics, where they, you know, like some guy in the back room of the comics publisher would color like 60 pages in a day. And it would be like, you know, detailed pressing that the artist had spent months on. He would just like color it orange. You know, it's like a little guy in the middle of orange. I love that. I couldn't make myself do it. It's not, my personality won't allow me to not like go over every little thing and get it exactly right. It was a failed experiment, but I still love looking at those pages.
Well, my guest who fails at failure is Daniel Klaus. His terrific new book is Monica. Dan, it's always great talking to you. You got to come back and do the show while I'm still alive. So please, let's not make it another 22 years.
God, no. That would be great. Thanks, Elvis.
That was our returning champion, graphic novel artist and writer Daniel Klaus, on his newest work, the graphic novel Monica. You can return to the archive at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Since they come back, why don't you on The Treatment?
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Boy, that Rebecca Miller just can't stand still. Her fingers are constantly working. She was last here about a year ago for her latest collection of short stories, Total, and she managed to find the time to write and direct another movie. This film is She Came to Me. And Rebecca, it's always good to have you here. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what the film's about and where the title comes from, because it's... It's literal in the way that shocked me.
The title is really, in a literal sense, it's about, like, she came to me. Somebody asks Stephen Laudem, who's played by Peter Dinklage, where the idea for his opera came from. And he says, the character, she came to me one day when I was taking a walk. And he's sort of convinced himself that he basically invented a woman that he, in fact, had an encounter with that changed his entire life and loosened up his creativity and enabled, but he's sort of repressed her as a human being. And then just moments later, she shows up and causes complete havoc in his life.
Well, but what's fun about this one, too, and you've never really quite done this before, is it's got farce timing. You know, it feels like watching Fade Out. And I wanted to ask you about that because it's, they're literally door slamming in this one, but but it's people running in and coming in and out of rooms. And I wondered if that was a conscious thing for you, if you set out to make something that was a farce, or is it, did it happen as you were writing the piece?
Well, I've always been really interested in how, in bending tone, you know, so you have a kind of farce timing at certain points, and certain characters definitely carry that. Like Brian D'Arcy James's character carries a lot of comedy, for example, or Marissa Tomei, in fact, they all do really, but then the tone will bend into a much more to pathos and real emotion, you know? And so I'm really interested in how to do that, but the whole, in a way, you could say that it's all about timing. I've never written anything or filmed anything that was so much about music, but also where the whole thing is musical. All of the storylines are kind of like musical phrases, and the whole way in which it weaves in and out, it's all about, you know, not smudging the syncopation, as he says in the rehearsal scene, but getting it right.
Because I feel like farce is a musical tone too. I mean, basically it has, it's all about timing and farce. And I thought this is being a series of chamber pieces almost, where each piece feels like kind of a suite.
When you put it all together though, it's quite a wide canvas for me. Like it's a broader, larger, just because of the number of worlds that we dive into. And so it kind of builds up into this slightly more operatic thing. And especially because the stakes get so high with the young people's dilemma, all of a sudden there's like an elevation of risk that I think kind of broadens the film a bit.
It's interesting to be able to ask you, writing a character with writer's block, it seems to be, I would imagine, something you've never encountered before. So it's almost like you had to put yourself in a totally different skin for this.
Well, I actually did have like some like serious writer's block a long time ago.
Really? How'd you deal with it?
Well, I was living in Ireland and I didn't know anyone at the time. My husband was working, so I was on my own a lot and I was completely blocked. And I was so blocked that I volunteered in a women's shelter with just thinking, well, at least I could do some good for somebody else since I'm obviously no good for myself. And that strangely unblocked me because it led to me writing the first story in the book, Personal Velocity of Stories, which then later led to the film and in fact brought me back to filmmaking because I had decided that I was giving up on filmmaking because I could never get any money. But it was this complete blockage. And I do think that in a way, there's a parallel in the sense that Stephen is so inside himself and cocooned inside himself that he's unable to make any headway creatively. And then it's only when other people, like namely Katrina, and finally then his stepson, break through that he, it's other people that in a way loosen his creativity. And I think that's part of what film is like talking about how we all create each other, how it's like this dance between people. There's no such thing as one's own creativity. It's always connected to others.
Well, that's so funny you say that because I feel like finally the film is about collaborating and that when Stephen becomes a collaborator again, or when he becomes a collaborator and when all these people are kind of working together and sort of finding somebody else to pay attention to and being pulled out of their own self-absorption, that's when they become fuller people. I mean, because we get to see his wife, what she's like on her own versus what she's like with him, and also the formality in that relationship. I mean, it feels like you set these characters out almost as archetypes to deal with, and then you humanize them over the course of the story, don't you?
Yes. It's like opening a door and then a door and then a door, and people surprise you. You know, you think they're one thing, and then it turns out that there's a completely different aspect to them, and that you keep falling through the floor. you know, falling through another floor, falling through another floor. And that's, in the end, like, my great motivation is just curiosity, intense curiosity about other people, you know. And like, when I sit in a train and look out the window, I just look at little houses and think, it drives me crazy that I don't get to know what they all have for breakfast.
It's the treatment. We're talking voyeurism with our guest, Rebecca Miller. Her new film is by the director. Is She Came to Me. You can also hear the show at kzrw.com/thetreatment. But there is that sense of voyeurism. I mean, that peering into people's lives. So often there are doorways and windows in your films. Entry point, literal entry points. And that's so crucial to She Came to Me. But that's something that really fascinates you in terms of visual storytelling, isn't it?
Yeah, people spying on each other, discovering windows into each other, a mother seeing photographs of her daughter, like erotic photographs of her daughter, and how that catalyzes the plot, or is a catalyst for the plot, or we're secretive to each other in a way where it's impossible to know anybody completely, but we're constantly getting these little windows into each other. And that's tantalizing. And yeah, I mean, I think I'm definitely a voyeuristic personality, but I think most people actually are.
Because you were saying secrets, and I want to ask you, it feels more like self-absorption to me, especially for the male characters. They don't seem to be able to see anything except what's right in front of them. And that's really for Brian Dusty James' character. You're talking about that too. He really like fixates on things when he sees them, and he only reacts to what's in front of him. And whereas the women seem to have fuller lives, I want to talk to you too about that kind of, that schism that exists between the males and females in the film.
I don't know. I mean, I definitely think it's true of Brian Darcy James's character, Trey. He's somebody who's quite literal and wishes he could live in the past. And that's where he feels safe. And I think he's a man of high native intelligence, but also extreme stupidity at the same time, which is something like that's a type of person. Like, you know, he has no sense of how he's affecting other people or how he's presenting himself with other people. And it's really made it really hard for him to advance in his life. And I mean, I don't know. I find his character actually quite fascinating. But like in terms of the Peter Dinklage character, I actually identify a lot with that character, which I don't know what that's
about. Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah, like it's certain ways. It's certain ways. I mean, like, you know, every writer puts a little of themselves into all over the place, you know, and they hide in unlikely places. And I think just in terms of like, what, like the rehearsal scene where he's so desperate for to get right and feeling like he can feel the music, what it should sound like, and it's just not happening. And like the frustration and the sense of extreme anxiety of being so exposed as an artist, you know, when he's standing backstage, and the feeling that I sometimes have when like a screening of mine is happening and I just want to die, you know, because it's so exposing and you're just lying there with no skin or just sitting in your seat and you just feel like, why did I ever want to do this? But I don't know, just the extreme vulnerability of being of the job.
You're talking about feeling exposed and watching it. I just thought you'd be laughing because it's funny from start to finish, even in the melodramatic moments, because there's so much going on. There's so much complication. There's so much information that's been withheld. I almost felt like this could have been a stage play.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Excepting that I had a lot of fun with the cinematic stuff. You know, like I definitely allowed myself a lot of fun with color and a lot of fun with like changing aspect ratios and just enjoying all the fun that you can have, you know, like going underwater and then coming out, you know, in another, you know, a year later and somewhere else. And just the pleasure of filmmaking would be lost. But definitely what you said about rhythm and about humor is really in the music, right? It's like the music of the words and how it lands in the ear. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And like when I taught, you know, working with these actors like Marissa Tomei and Peter Dinklage and Anne Hathaway, the capacity to express sadness and anxiety, but also the comedic side of that too, and bend the tone like into comedy within something that's quite serious is like so hard. And I just feel like the way that they are able to do that for me was really quite remarkable.
Talk about, you know, getting Bryce Dessner in this, because you got, even got a Springsteen song in this. I mean, and this, as you're saying, it's quite a musical film.
Yeah. I mean, Bryce Dessner was recommended to me by my dear friend, Katia Labeck, who's one of the great classical pianists in Europe and in the world. She works with her sister a lot, Mariella Beck. Bryce had written a beautiful piano concerto for the both of them. And for this, I really felt like he needed somebody. Of course, he's in the National, he's a rock star, but he also is a classical composer. And he really has composed opera, and he does concertos, and he understands what this music would really sound like. You know, I didn't want a pastiche. I didn't want an imitation or something, especially because some of the comedy is carried in a few of the details of the first opera. But I didn't want to be making fun of the music, if you know what I mean. I wanted it to be really gorgeous, real music. And so he had to compose the two scenes of two a scene each, the last scene each of two original operas before we started shooting so that we could prepare it so that we could shoot the scenes. It was a huge undertaking. And I always felt like I wanted Katia Levesque to be playing on the score. So he created this beautiful lush piano score, which also has some strings on it, but it's a wonderful score, I think. And so that part of it was a unique collaboration. I mean, I've worked with Michael Rahatton many times as a wonderful musician and composer, but with Bryce, I just wanted somebody from that world who really understood that world.
I mean, this is a thing that's run through, I think, all of your work. And I know we've talked about it before, which is this need to connect that people have, how it manifests itself and how people come to recognize it or don't, but it's there even if they can't speak it. And that's the difference for me between the younger characters and if you pardon the expression, the adults, at least the younger characters know what it is they want. And these appetites are kind of pure for them. That actually feels operatic to me in a figurative sense. And I wondered about that insertion too, because it does feel like another kind of musical interlude to me.
The story of the young lovers was something I had wanted to tell for a long time. I remember talking to Cindy Tolan, my casting director, for like the last 30 years. I said to her, you know, I want to make a movie where the idea that there's a young couple and they're going to maybe break up, like, is a sensible thing to do with your first boyfriend. You don't, you know, stay with them forever. But the boy says, you know, if we break up and I get married, do the reasonable thing, all my life I'm going to wonder where you are. It seemed to me just such a romantic idea. And like, how do I back into this, that, you know, that statement?
There's almost a need for a song in the sections with them. You know what I mean? I mean, it feels so, there's a kind of yearning and a purity and this, you know, like you're saying, these questions about the future in the concrete and in the abstract that are really about the way that these young people who also aren't being seen by their parents.
Yes, and who kind of insist on being seen finally, and that the parents are able to see them. Maybe not love what they see in terms of, you know, the outcome. You know, because we're all creating each other in various ways. I mean, in one sense, I think we're all projecting onto each other identities that don't necessarily have that much to do with what's really going on. I mean, that's true of parent to child, child to parent, lover to lover, husband to wife, wife to husband. There's no question that there's some projection always happening. Then it's like, what happens when you finally rip the mask down and you really make an effort to see the person as they are? And can you tolerate that? You know, yeah, you know, and it's funny what you said about like, it could be a play. I think it could be more like maybe the whole thing could be an opera or a musical, like something where people had arias. I think that would make a lot of sense. Yeah.
It's so interesting too that I talked about archetypes with you, just because each character has something to play. It seems like once you get a third of the way in, it goes from being slightly mysterious to as soon as somebody enters, we know exactly what it is that they want, even though they don't seem to want it. And I want to ask you about that, because that seems like a really hard thing to do. For me, it's about you cramming so much stuff in, which is the way I think about you. And I wonder if that was a goal you gave yourself to just sort of like, okay, once everybody's been introduced, let's just like get right to it, because that becomes, for me, part of the farce mechanism.
Yes. I mean, I thought, you know, with Peter's character, like Stephen Lodem is like one thing about him. And this is something I've seen in people, especially guys, I got to say, some big men I've known, where they're completely disconnected from their own will and they can't act. They can't make decisions. And I think that's the whole thing of like, he's letting his dog decide which way to go on a walk because he can't decide. Because each way is fraught with peril, potential risk. You know, and he, as probably all of them are, is a very unconscious person. And you almost are rooting for them to just become themselves. You're like, do it already. You know, we see it. We see who you need to be.
Sure. And to that end, it's almost to some extent, and it really sort of flowers at the end of the movie. They're all kind of, in some ways, even the teenagers are kind of walking through a dream. They're all in kind of a fugue state. It feels like, you know, almost like the Magic Flute or something in some ways.
So funny that you say that, because definitely Magic Flute and Midsummer Night's Dream were two things that I did think a lot about when I was
really
constructing this. Yes. Because, you know, that it's that archetypal romance where the wrong couples are with each other, then and there's this whole exchange and a kind of, and there's a level of like magic dust sprinkled on things. And, you know, there's, it's functioning on that magic realism level, but it's also just quotidian and everyday, and you recognize people. So it's kind of trying to be both of those things, you know, because I sometimes get quite disconnected from a purely surreal thing. But whereas if you can still have blood and guts involved, but you're also, because in the end, being a human being, like all people are in a dream state all day because your unconscious is working all the time. So you're never totally awake, I would say.
Wow. Well, that's probably a good point to end it because we're out of time. So we'll just wait for, I guess, another year before Rebecca Miller comes back with something new. In the interim, we can satisfy ourselves with a new film as writer-director if she came to me. Rebecca, thank you so much for doing this.
Elvis, thank you so much. I love talking to you.
Stranger, pump that jukebox with your quarters. We all deserve a second chance. Darling, let me tell you your future. Slip your palm into my hands.
Rebecca Miller, prolific short story writer and screenwriter and director. Her newest is the film She Came to Me, Another Return. Emma Seligman, Bottoms writer-director, goes back to the 80s and the first filmmaker to deal with teen angst as a real issue. You can return to The Treat at kcrw.com/thetreat.
With all the blessings that it grants.
Writer-director Emma Seligman came back to a tradition of teen tragicomedy for her film Bottoms. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. Seligman salutes the creator of the genre Bottoms traffics in for her treat.
Hi, I'm Emma Seligman, and this is The Treat.
Oh, yeah.
A movie that has inspired me continuously, that I've watched many times over, that specifically inspired both Shiva Baby and Bottoms, is Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I think that's because it is a movie that takes young people seriously while, you know, still being a comedy. And I think that especially as a kid, I hadn't seen a teen movie that had kind of, you know, an existentialism and, you know, an accurate portrayal of teenage angst and depression so accurately and authentically. You know, especially in the performances.
He'll keep calling me. He'll keep calling me until I come over. He'll make me feel guilty. This is ridiculous, okay? I'll go.
It's also just such a wonderful coming-of-age story in a day. And it feels whimsical and kind of experimental in the fact that you don't necessarily know where the plot is going. And yet it's also very tight, you know, as a narrative. And it has these beautiful set pieces like Twist and Shout and these other sort of diversions of plot that don't necessarily need, they're not required in order to tell this story. But it's quite a character-driven movie.
Look, it's real nice that you hope my brother's feeling better, but I'm in danger, okay? I am very cute, I am very alone, and I'm very protective of my body. I do not want it violated or killed, all right? I need help!
I mean, the costumes and the production design in Ferris Bueller's Day Off is so specific and character-driven and, yeah, allows each of the performances and the characters to stand out in their scenes. And it's so clear, like, he has such wonderful active, you know, collaborations creatively with his people, you know, behind the scenes, and makes the teen movie look so beautiful and takes it seriously, like as a genre. Like, just because it's a teen comedy doesn't mean that the costumes need to be basic or that it needs to be lit super, you know, lazily, if that's, you know, the right word. So I tried to take inspiration from that kind of visual detail. it never gets old. And somehow the last line of the movie still makes me cry, like, every time I watch it.
Yep. I said it before and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
And I think, you know, is relatable for any age, you know, of the audience member who watches it.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Dark as shame, darling, dark as shame. Thank you for all the joy and pain.
From Emma Seligman, writer-director of Bottoms, The Treat. Ferris Bueller's Day Off from writer-director John Hughes. Past treats, such as Spinning Gold filmmaker Timothy Scott Bogart revisiting a film he borrows from at kcrw.com/thetreat. Movies, music, art, friends, real life, the catalyst that set off the creative lives of artists of every stripe. It's what we call The Treat. What We Call The Treatment is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. What We Call Help, we get from Anna Buss and Laura Kondarajan every week. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
What a mess, I confess, that's not all. Dark as shame, darling, dark as shame. Thank you for walks down lover's lane. I can't see.